You cannot imagine what an honor it is for me to be with you today, delivering the 2014 Ola B. Smith Lecture here at my alma mater. I still remember exactly where I stood roughly 20 years ago when I received my letter of admission to the law school, and as if it was yesterday, I remember the first time that I walked the grounds and witnessed the purple shadows dancing across the lawn. The law school looked a lot different in 1995 when I arrived. My class had the pleasure of witnessing the transformation of our old law school into this beautiful space that now so perfectly expresses Jefferson's concept of an academical village, weaving together elements of academia and learning and community. It may seem a strange thing to say to law students toiling through all that a law school education requires, but I cherished my time here at Virginia. I have vivid memories of our new student reception on the lawn, the dandelion parade our first year, and then Dean Bob Scott demonstrating ambitious loft on his opening pitch to start the softball season my first year. I also have memories of countless bruises from unpredictable bounces down the third baseline at Copley Field. I remember vividly the late Professor Jeffrey O'Connell describing the gut-wrenching realities of personal injury trial work. Professor A.E. Dick Howard's revelations concerning the impossibly difficult task of drafting constitutions for fledgling democracies. And Dean Bob Scott utilizing a tennis metaphor on the first day of class to explain how he would teach us proficiency in contracts. More relevant, perhaps, to many of you here today, I remember my last spring here in Charlottesville. After 3 years in law school, I was anxious to get off the sidelines and into the game, and yet I felt quite sentimental about leaving this place that changed my life in so many ways in just 3 short years. Countless experiences on these grounds, both in and out of the classroom, shaped my early approach to the law, first as an advocate and now as a judge. I left the law school firmly committed to advancing this noble profession through my conduct as an attorney, acting as a responsible steward for those who required assistance, and searching for opportunities to serve my community in the bar. I'm deeply humbled now to be providing that service as a judge. If I'm being honest, I was surprised when I was admitted to the law school, and I was stunned when I was confirmed as a federal trial court judge 14 years after leaving. It is not a path I could ever have imagined or foreseen. With that context in mind, I spent considerable time thinking about what I might have to share with you that would be hopefully relevant and interesting. As part of that process, I reviewed past Ola B. Smith lecture topics. As you likely know, some renowned jurists have delivered from this podium profound insights in recent years on topics including the unique qualities of the D.C. Circuit, international human rights in American courts, threats to judicial independence, the constitutionality and advisability of recess appointments of Article III judges, judicial perspectives on national security trials, and many other momentous and timely issues. As the title of this discussion reveals, I have settled on something of a different course. Immediately upon coming to the bench, I made a conscious decision to remain connected to the bar, to sear into my memory the practical realities and difficulties of trial work for lawyers and their clients, and to remain grounded in those experiences that led me to the other side of the courtroom. The work of a trial court judge is far too important, in my view, to allow our egos to interfere with producing the best decisions and results possible for the parties. I'm reminded that for most of the litigants who appear before us, the events transpiring in court are often among the most important things then happening in their lives, whether because their liberty or the liberty of a loved one is at stake, or because a significant dispute, injury, or right is at issue. In light of this, I have adopted what I think can best be described as a pragmatic approach to judicial service. From the beginning of my tenure on the bench, I committed myself to asking the questions I needed to ask to satisfy myself of the results the law required us to reach. even if I was fearful that those questions would reveal some level of ignorance or inexperience. Before coming to the bench, I prosecuted and defended criminal cases, worked as a civil defense attorney, practiced plaintiff's work, and for roughly the last half of my career, engaged mostly in commercial litigation. While I was more fortunate than I ever could have guessed to have been exposed during my practice to such a broad range of experiences, no person comes to the bench prepared for the breadth of issues judges confront on a daily basis. In this way, assuming the bench is a lot like returning to law school. It seems almost inevitable today that lawyers gradually, or sometimes rapidly, narrow the scope of their practice and develop expertise in discrete areas of the law. By virtue of our work, judges move in the opposite direction. We are, of necessity, generalists. This is one of my very favorite aspects of this job. We are continuously learning about new areas of the law and new subjects. For example, on Monday, we might be considering the constitutionality of Utah's time, place, and manner restrictions on free speech. We might then turn on Wednesday to construing patent claims for exercise devices. On Friday, we might take up business compliance with EPA Clean Air Act requirements. And in between all of that, we might consider whether a defendant in a criminal case should be involuntarily medicated against his will to render him competent to stand trial and to assist in his defense. We engage nearly every day in mind-expanding and challenging exercises. I firmly believe in the importance of making our courtrooms available to litigants. In my view, nothing inspires more confidence in our judiciary than providing litigants the experience of being in court to observe their lawyers articulating their cases before a judge who is well-prepared, engaged, impartial, open-minded, respectful, and committed to applying the rule of law dispassionately. This is the experience I strive to provide to litigants in our court. And by virtue of that experience, I hope that win, lose, or draw, litigants leave our court feeling that they have been treated fairly and respectfully by the judicial system, even if they ultimately disagree with the final result. This requires great effort, especially as a new judge. Coming up to speed as a new trial court judge is as intense as it is consuming. I've been on the bench now for just over 1.5 years. It is quite remarkable how much you are exposed to and how much you learn when you are in the courtroom for virtually hours every single day. Based on the depth and breadth of my experiences over that time, it now seems to me that we should measure time on the bench in dog years. And by that measure, I've been on the bench for about 11 years, and sometimes it feels that way. Given the recency of my appointment, I often feel as though I stand with one leg on each side of the bench. The difficulties and challenges of a trial court practice remain fresh in my mind as I now experience our courtroom proceedings from an entirely new perspective behind the bench. This has caused me to reflect often on things I have learned navigating these new experiences and with the benefit of this new perspective. Mindful of the audience here today, I would like to share with you 3 observations that resonate with some significance for me in light of my experiences as a recently appointed trial court judge. While this is something of a departure from past presentations here, my hope is that you will find something in these comments that will aid you as you transition from students to practitioners. The vast majority of my comments are directed to my observations concerning the brilliance of our jury system and the critical importance of a strong, independent judiciary. Of course, neither of these is a particularly novel topic. Both featured prominently in the formation of our constitutional form of government hundreds of years ago. Jefferson wrote much about the importance of jury trials and judicial independence. Both are explicitly cited in the Declaration of Independence, where it was specifically noted that the King of Great Britain had obstructed the administration of justice by refusing to assent to laws establishing a judiciary, had made judges dependent on his will alone for their tenure and for the amount of their salaries, and that he had deprived colonists of the benefits of trial by jury. Hamilton's Federalist No. 78, titled The Judiciary Department, is the most cited of the Federalist essays by our Supreme Court justices. Published in May 1788, Hamilton famously articulated there the rationale for a strong, independent judiciary. Among other things, he said, I think with some foresight, "If then the courts of justice are to be considered as the bulwarks of a limited constitution against legislative encroachments, this consideration will afford a strong argument for the permanent tenure of judicial offices, since nothing will contribute so much as this to that independent spirit in the judges which must be essential to the faithful performance of so arduous a duty. This independence of the judges is equally requisite to guard the Constitution and the rights of individuals from the effects of those ill humors which the arts of designing men or the influence of particular conjectures sometimes disseminate among the people, and which, though they speedily give place to better information and more deliberate reflection, have a tendency in the meantime to occasion dangerous innovations in the government and serious oppressions of the minor party in the community." Well familiar with these sentiments long before I came here to law school, my time on the bench only causes me to more fully appreciate the genius of our founding fathers. Insofar as my comments today reveal my advocacy for our jury system and judicial independence, I take comfort knowing that I keep good company. I turn first to my perceptions concerning the magnificence of our jury system. In 1965, Chief Justice Warren provided a brief history of the right to trial by jury in Singer versus United States. Notably, before recognition of the right of the accused to a trial by jury, criminal cases in England were decided by compurgation, ordeal, or battle. Of these, ordeal was easily your least favorite if you were charged with a crime. Ordeal was a primitive form of trial that relied on divine intervention to establish the guilt or innocence of the accused. This often involved subjecting an accused to a dangerous or gruesome physical test. At least one manifestation of trial by ordeal will be familiar to those of you who are fans of the old Monty Python films, which included humorous exchanges about ordeal by water. This form of ordeal required the accused be trussed and lowered into a pond. If the accused sank to the bottom, it was an indication of God's acceptance of the accused, who was then, quite ironically, adjudged innocent. Those who floated were believed to be rejected by God and were deemed guilty. Sometime after about the 13th century, trial by jury had largely displaced alternative forms of trial in criminal cases in England. However, a defendant was entitled to a jury trial only if he or she consented, and many defendants refused to consent for fear of a conviction, which then resulted in the deprivation of the defendant's lands and substantial hardships for their descendants. Those who did not consent to a jury trial were viewed as refusing to stand to the common law of the land and were tortured until death or until they consented to a jury. This practice was not abolished in England until 1772, and it was not until 1827, long after the adoption of our Constitution, that England promulgated a statute providing the right to trial by jury to an accused who would not otherwise admit his guilt. In an attempt to protect defendants from governmental oppression, the framers of our Constitution included provisions guaranteeing the right to a speedy and public trial of the criminally accused before an impartial jury of their peers. In a profound and revolutionary move at the time, our founders also chose to make juries available to resolve civil disputes between litigants. This right is found in the Seventh Amendment. That may all sound well and good, but my belief is that these rights are now so ingrained in our American tradition that they are largely taken for granted by nearly all citizens who have been fortunate enough to avoid the necessity of seeking a jury to vindicate a right, challenge government action, or resolve an important civil dispute. For example, it seems to me virtually impossible to fully appreciate the crucial check our jury system provides on prosecutorial discretion, unless you have witnessed firsthand the crushing pressure that a government prosecution brings to bear on a criminal defendant and her family. Nor do I think most citizens can appreciate the importance of juries in civil cases until they find themselves or those close to them haled into court unjustly in a civil case or grievously injured by a party who cannot be held to account in damages except by an impartial jury of peers. Much has been written about the importance of our jury system and its essential role in preserving our democracy. My dear friend and former law partner Richard Burbidge articulated this concept more eloquently than I ever could in an address he delivered to the International Academy of Trial Lawyers this past February as its dean. As Mr. Burbidge explained, there is only one branch of government in which reasoned discussion can and does occur. In courtrooms around this great nation, as in few other places on the face of the earth, the great and the humble, the rich and the unwashed, not only may speak truth to power without fear of reprisal, but must do so. Courtrooms are the places in which the consequences of human behavior, its abuses, its thoughtfulness, its thoughtlessness, its mendacity, its honesty, its good and its evil are made plain, understood, and addressed. The ground around the great and the small is made level, more or less, by the talent, zeal, and commitment of dedicated advocates and the fair and even application of the rules of engagement by independent judges. Juries, composed of our fellow citizens, examining the evidence, observing the testimony, and hearing the argument, assess, interpret, judge credibility, and render a verdict upon it. In our courts of justice, truth, born of vetted evidence, is the only acceptable medium of exchange. When disputes arise, there are such forums in every village, town, city, county, and state, and in our nation's capital, in which rational, predictable, and traditional rules can be applied with integrity and impartiality. These venues are the places where the smallest voices seeking justice may be amplified and resonate with the same force and clarity as those of the most powerful. These are the places where numbers and statistics give way to real people who have suffered, that others may avoid suffering in the future. While the vast number of citizens may be yet unaffected, the hidden defect is exposed to a jury of citizens in open court. Crushing injustices are explored, and fundamental rights and protections can be restored. Mr. Burbidge finds himself in good company. Indeed, much has been made in recent years of the importance of preserving this fundamental aspect of our democracy through active practice and utilization. My colleague, Judge Mark Bennett, a trial court judge in the Northern District of Iowa, authored a sharp commentary on the disappearing civil jury trial in a piece styled Obituary, The American Trial Lawyer. I recommend it to you as a piercing satirical commentary on the consequences of there being fewer jury trials in our courts. Judge Bennett said this to open. The American trial lawyer, who in innumerable ways enhanced the lives of so many Americans and made the United States a fairer, healthier, safer, more egalitarian, and just nation, passed away recently. Although a precise age is uncertain, the American trial lawyer is believed to have been 371 years old at the time of death. Noting that the precise cause of death was uncertain, Judge Bennett attributed to a blue ribbon panel of forensic coroners several conclusions, including the fact that the death was not sudden, but rather the result of a long-term progressive illness that worsened over the last 40 years. Among factors likely contributing to the demise of the American trial lawyer, Judge Bennett identified the following. A strange autoimmune disease known as Iqbal and Twombly. A surge of litigation industry, lymphoblastic cancer cells, replacing healthy trial lawyer skill cells. The vanishing civil jury trial, causing a massive drain of healthy red blood cells that were the lifeblood of the American trial lawyer. A genetic mutation of the civil justice system that came to be known as ADR. The tragic inability of young offspring of the American trial lawyer to obtain an essential growth hormone, trial experience. The inability of the courts to implement reforms that would have reduced the enormous costs of getting cases to trial and enabled the American trial lawyer to go off life support. And the media, which, with the speed of an aggressive glioblastoma, spread inaccurate information about allegedly frivolous lawsuits and verdicts, like the McDonald's hot coffee case. While others with greater experience and broader perspective are more capable of speaking to the importance of jury trials, viewing the jury system in practice from behind the bench has provided me with something of a unique and inspiring perspective into what I perceive to be the brilliance of our jury system as it operates in our courts throughout this nation on a daily basis. It is this practical ground-level experience I draw on now to hopefully illustrate this greatness. But first, a few words about my earliest experiences with juries while here in school at Virginia and in my clerkship immediately following graduation. The prosecution clinic here at Virginia supplied my first exposure to jury trials. Clinics are far more common now than they were when I was in school. The faculty and administration here undoubtedly have their own views on this, but I sensed until relatively recently a real reluctance on the part of law schools to embrace the concept of clinical experience as part of a law school curriculum. If this was so, I think it was likely a reflection of then-existing ideas both about the proper scope of a legal education, but also about the availability of critical mentoring and on-the-job training following graduation. I was recently speaking with a friend who is in the second year of a master's program in architecture. When he finishes his program and receives his degree, he will be required to work in something of an apprenticeship for 2 full years before he will even be permitted to sit for his licensing examination. And so it used to be for lawyers. Whether graduating attorneys accepted employment in large or small firms, in big cities or rural communities, in-house with companies, in government positions or otherwise, nearly all of us received the benefit of intensive mentoring from skilled and experienced lawyers as we learned our complicated art. Partially as a result of gradual trends in demographics, and more recently, I think, in response to a bruising legal market for new lawyers, it seems for years now, new graduates increasingly find themselves starting out on their own or in positions in which traditional mentoring is unavailable. Given the staggering impact that lawyers have on the lives of those we serve, this has been an alarming development. It is, I believe, what has motivated so many states, including Utah, to adopt formal mentoring programs for new lawyers, in which recent bar admittees and experienced practitioners pair up for a year or longer to work through a series of specific mentoring objectives. I suspect this same issue, coupled with greater interest from students, caused law schools around the nation to gradually increase the number and breadth of clinical programs now available for credit as part of our law school curricula. Regardless, I was thrilled when the law school made available a prosecution clinic while I was here as a student. I believed at the time that I wanted to be a prosecutor when I graduated, and I was eager to get into court as early and often as possible. Students in the prosecution clinic were assigned to various federal, state, and county prosecutors' offices. As a third-year law student, I was assigned to the Fluvanna County Commonwealth Attorney's Office. This reference will likely be lost on many of you, but driving into Palmyra, about 20 miles southwest of here, in 1997, bore a striking resemblance to driving into Mayberry, in a fantastic, charming way. The so-called Old Fluvanna County Courthouse, built in 1831, sits atop a small hill in the center of town. It is classically Virginia in design, constructed of red-orange brick and with 4 stately columns in the front. At least when I was spending 2 days a week there, the building lacked air conditioning. And while climate control may have been lacking, seersucker suits were not. Colin Guy, the Fluvanna Commonwealth attorney at the time, was my first legal mentor. My work with him my third year may well have ruined the experience for those of you who followed, but Mr. Guy gave me my own calendar and allowed me to run my own cases. Notwithstanding my rapt attention and my best efforts, I think the results are probably best described as mixed. It was in that beautiful historic courthouse that I had my first experiences with jurors. But my most memorable moment that year involved a case that I lost in spectacular fashion even before it got to a jury. I somehow managed to lose a felony hit-and-run case when the judge threw the case out of court in response to a defense theory that the accused was so drunk at the time that he ran somebody off the road that he couldn't possibly have known he had just caused an accident, and he therefore lacked the necessary mens rea to support a conviction for leaving the scene. While I first argued to juries here in Virginia, I first gained perspective from behind the curtain when I returned to Salt Lake City following graduation for a clerkship with District Judge J. Thomas Green. Our first jury trial with Judge Green was a three-week bombing trial in which several defendants in their late teens were charged with bombing facilities used for raising and holding mink. The defendants, recent high school graduates, were members of the Animal Liberation Front. Speaking to the extraordinary weight of a federal prosecution I mentioned a few moments ago, one of the accused took his own life days before the trial began. The trial was fiercely contested and well tried by skilled advocates both on behalf of the government and for each of the defendants. The jury ultimately acquitted on all counts. As is the practice among most of the judges in our district, Judge Green met with the jurors in chambers following the verdict. What I witnessed was an emotional and raw exchange, with several jurors breaking down into tears. The jurors expressed to Judge Green their desire that he communicate to the lead prosecutor for the government the jury's appreciation for the trial the United States had put on. The jurors explained that they all believed these defendants had committed those crimes charged. But after studying the jury instructions and deliberating at length, they were unable to conclude that the government's proof rose to the requisite level of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. It became apparent during the discussion in chambers that these jurors had taken their charge very seriously. They had fully committed themselves to applying the law as instructed and had carefully and impartially evaluated all of the evidence in the case before reaching a fair and impartial verdict. As a law clerk, it inspired in me great confidence in our jury system. Countless other experiences during my clerkship and throughout my years of practice as an attorney further reinforced my confidence in juries. That confidence is skyrocketing now as I interact directly with juries and trials over which I preside in our court. My first criminal jury trial and my first civil jury trial provide sound examples, I think, of the extraordinary level of commitment and sacrifice I see from our jurors. One of the files I inherited upon my appointment to the bench was a 2009 case charging a Utah National Guard officer and Afghanistan war veteran with possessing and distributing child pornography. Roughly 100 days after I became a judge, the case went to trial, dragging me along with it. It was my first trial as a judge. Every element of the charged offenses was at issue. You can imagine, then, the kind of proof the government was required to put on at trial. It's safe to say, I think, that there are few types of cases a new judge would be more apprehensive about presiding over in an initial trial. Given the subject matter and the length of our trial, we called a sizable pool of prospective jurors. The venire filled every seat in our spacious courtroom. Because Utah is composed of a single judicial district, our jury pool is drawn from the entire state. It is my practice at the beginning of jury selection to have each prospective juror stand and introduce themselves with answers to 10 short biographical questions. During jury selection in that first trial, and in each instance since, I was struck by the fact that our venire represented an impressive cross-section of our community. Save possibly for race, it is Utah, after all, we consistently pull an impressively diverse jury pool in nearly all respects. We regularly draw students to retirees, professionals to blue-collar workers, stay-at-home parents, business owners, government employees, and teachers. After a full day of jury selection, we impaneled a 12-member jury and two alternates. Our jury was remarkable only for how typical it was. The evidence at trial ranged from expert testimony concerning highly technical aspects of the operations of computer file sharing programs running over the internet, to presentation of grisly videos depicting children engaged in indescribable behavior. The file names for the videos alone were enough to cause everyone in the courtroom significant discomfort. It was January in Utah, and it was stormy throughout the trial. The afternoon the government put on the video evidence seized from the defendant's computers, we had a substantial winter storm. Keeping an eye on the jury as the evidence came in, I thought it quite likely that several of them were going to be physically ill in the jury box. Our jury kept with it. The court closed early due to the storm, but we pushed through with our jury into the evening. Schools were closed the following morning and the roads were a mess. Every juror was at court the next morning, on time, and ready to get back to work. And while we had impaneled two alternate jurors, anticipating a strong possibility that we might lose one or two jurors given the subject matter of the trial, all 12 jurors completed their service. Our jury was attentive and engaged throughout the trial. They worked very hard. Our jury ultimately convicted the defendant of both possession and distribution of child pornography. Meeting with the jury in chambers following the verdict, you could not help but be moved by what these citizens had just done. They had been exposed to some of the most disturbing evidence you can ever imagine putting in front of jurors. It was, in my view, the kind of evidence that can change people, and it showed on their faces after the trial had ended. Notwithstanding that, it was clear to me that our jurors had focused on the court's instructions, had carefully considered the elements of the charges, evaluated the evidence, and without prejudice or bias flowing from what they had witnessed in the courtroom, our jury had done their best to reach a fair and impartial verdict in accordance with the law and based on the evidence. Our visit in chambers convinced me that those jurors walked away from that challenging and difficult case believing that they had provided important and meaningful service, and they had. I thought the service they provided was courageous and extraordinary. Our first civil jury trial provided another inspiring, confidence-building example of our jury system in action, though in a much different way than our child pornography case did. This trial illustrated, in my view, the synergy our juries often enjoy when you blend a group of citizens, each with different life experiences, viewpoints, and skill sets. Our first civil jury case involved a medical doctor who claimed to have invented a new method for surgical, fusionless treatment of scoliosis in children. In short, our plaintiff doctor alleged that a large medical device company had fraudulently induced him into entering into a confidential disclosure agreement and a subsequent license agreement. The plaintiff alleged that once he entered into those agreements, the medical device company breached those agreements, stole his intellectual property, and obtained its own patents on his property without telling him. We again encountered in our courtroom on the first morning of trial a fascinating cross-section of our community. We eventually impaneled a jury that included a self-described high school dropout, a construction manager, a student, a full-time church employee responsible for providing food and resources to people in need, a retiree, and a number of folks employed in a broad range of professional and unskilled positions. One juror was a new citizen of the United States who could not have been more proud to be serving on a jury. The trial lasted 2 long weeks, with our trial days extending well into the evening several nights in order to finish when we promised. The evidence was highly technical and very complex. It involved animal studies, patent claims, FDA practices, complicated contracts, the reasonableness of certain business judgments and practices, and claimed medical trade secrets. Every juror was at court early every day, ready to work, engaged and focused on the testimony and the evidence. The jury ultimately deliberated late into the evening on a Friday after closing arguments and returned to resume deliberations at 8:30 Saturday morning. They returned a verdict only to move into a punitive damages phase Saturday afternoon based on their answers to some questions on the jury verdict form. We finally finished Saturday evening with the jury returning a verdict for the plaintiff in the amount of $51 million. Meeting with them in chambers, after conclusion of the trial, I again found a collection of citizens who seemed deeply concerned about whether they had performed their duty well. They were keenly aware of the importance of their work to the parties and had clearly worked diligently through the court's lengthy jury instructions and the facts to reach the best decision they could. In addition to their level of commitment and the seriousness about which they undertook their work, it was striking to see how this collection of citizens from our community, each with their own life experiences and views, had collectively worked together to navigate through enormously complicated and technical matters. Of course, juries are reflections of the communities from which they're drawn. They necessarily operate differently in different parts of this great nation. While they are hardly infallible and sometimes make mistakes, my experiences with juries during my relatively short time on the bench so far have only confirmed my conviction that our jury system is properly the envy of so many nations around the world. I turn now to my second observation. Although I am certain that some of my written decisions over the last few months have caused many to reach a different conclusion, my time on the bench has also confirmed in my mind the advisability of life tenure for judges and the importance of an independent judiciary. The process of selecting and confirming federal judges has become quite long and uncertain. There are many reasons for this and many consequences as well. Numerous commentators have expressed alarm and concern about the pace and difficulty of filling judicial vacancies on the federal bench. The result of the current nomination and confirmation climate for me was that I was involved in the process that ultimately led to my appointment for nearly 2 full years. For a good portion of that time, one of my very closest friends, James Blanche, a UVA undergrad, was simultaneously applying for appointment as a Utah State Court trial judge. Judge Blanche was confirmed to the 3rd Judicial District Court in Salt Lake County several months before I came to the federal bench in 2012. By virtue of working through our respective courses at about the same time, we spent countless hours debating various theories about judicial process, substantive legal questions, procedure, and numerous other subjects. We are both self-described law geeks with great interest in such things. One topic we frequently discussed was the advisability of life tenure for judges. To us, this seemed an important issue, even as we found ourselves rehashing arguments first articulated well over 200 years ago by the framers of our Constitution. By statute, judges in Utah periodically stand for uncontested retention elections. The retention elections are conducted in conjunction with the state's general elections. Depending on the year of appointment, each judge first sits for retention between about 4 to 6 years after coming to the state court bench, and then about every 6 years thereafter. In connection with the retention elections, the bar and the courts gather data and feedback from lawyers and the public relating to each judge who stands for retention. That information is then provided to the electorate, who simply votes yes or no in response to the question whether each individual judge should be retained. Judge Blanche and I both viewed this process to be infinitely better than the practice in some states of holding contested elections for judicial office. Many of you may have seen the HBO documentary film Hot Coffee, referenced in Judge Bennett's obituary piece. While it seems to me something less than a completely impartial investigation, the film, named after the infamous case involving spilled McDonald's coffee, presents an interesting perspective on some of the most troubling consequences of contested judicial elections. In our discussions, Judge Blanche and I largely focused on the perceived advantages and disadvantages of life tenure for judges and whether a modified approach, like the one utilized in Utah, better safeguards against judicial abuse while simultaneously providing for an adequate level of judicial independence. My friend felt strongly that Utah's model was generally superior to our federal Article III life tenure approach. I think it's fair to say I was mostly undecided about the issue. And then, about 5 months into my tenure as a new judge, I was randomly assigned a case filed by three couples challenging the constitutionality of Utah's laws banning same-sex marriage. At the time, I was generally aware of the Windsor case pending before the Supreme Court involving a challenge of a portion of the Defense of Marriage Act, but at least in part as a result of the workload associated with coming up to speed as a new judge, I had not really followed the case or any of the commentary following. My wife reminds me infrequently of the schedule I adopted upon taking the bench. In our district, new judges are assigned a specific number of criminal and civil cases from each of the other district court judges in order to instantly rebalance dockets. The practical effect of this for new judges is that you immediately inherit hundreds of cases and motions, some of them quite urgent, some of them quite old, and some of them spectacularly ugly. Triaging cases, putting out fires, adopting chambers practices, and digging out from under the mountain of assigned work required all of our energy and all of our attention. Our entire chambers was working feverishly to get through all of the important work before us. The last thing on my mind last March was the possibility that I would be required to evaluate the constitutionality of Utah's same-sex marriage laws. It took all of about 30 seconds after I learned that we drew the case to conclude that it was a no-win situation for me as a judge. I had no idea at the time how the case would evolve procedurally, what arguments and issues the parties would raise, or how those issues would be resolved. The only thing about which I had any real confidence was that, regardless of the decision we ultimately reached on the merits, if we got to the merits, I was very likely going to be excoriated by the losing side. Particularly in light of the recency of my appointment, the enormous volume of work on our plates, and the highly political nature of the issue presented, it is hard to overstate how concerned I was to have been assigned the case. And yet, I took an oath of office, accepting this appointment, that requires me to faithfully discharge the duties of this position, including the responsibility to address those issues properly before me. Our Utah case was filed and assigned to me months before the Supreme Court issued its DOMA decision. After that case was filed, but before the state of Utah responded, the parties jointly requested that I temporarily stay the case until after the Supreme Court ruled in Windsor. Once that decision issued last summer, the plaintiffs in our case sought to proceed immediately into discovery. The state of Utah objected, insisting that the issues presented in the lawsuit were exclusively legal. As something of a compromise, I agreed to let the state file a summary judgment motion at the beginning of the case to determine whether the issues could be resolved or narrowed at the outset. The state of Utah persuaded me not to enter a scheduling order and to stay any discovery in the case until after resolution of the state's motions. I gave the plaintiffs an election to either simultaneously file a cross motion for summary judgment or just simply to respond to the state's motion. In either event, given the length of time the case was pending without any discovery, I promised to timely decide whatever summary judgment motions were filed. At the plaintiff's urging, I set a hearing for January 7th of this year to forge a scheduling order in our case to address any issues remaining once we resolved whatever motions we ultimately received from the parties. It was not until the parties submitted cross motions for summary judgment a month or so later that we discovered that both sides were urging us to decide the constitutionality of Utah's same-sex marriage ban as a matter of law, without discovery and without a trial. With the benefit of the parties' briefing, framing the issues, and articulating the arguments, we undertook our legal analysis, which is set forth in a 53-page memorandum decision entered in the case December 20 last year. The opening passage of my written opinion describes the issue presented and the conclusion I reached. We said there, the plaintiffs in this lawsuit are three gay and lesbian couples who wish to marry, but are currently unable to do so because the Utah Constitution prohibits same-sex marriage. The plaintiffs argue that this prohibition infringes their right to due process and equal protection under the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution. The state of Utah defends its laws and maintains that a state has the right to define marriage according to the judgment of its citizens. Both parties have submitted motions for summary judgment. The court agrees with Utah that regulation of marriage has traditionally been the province of the states and remains so today. But any regulation adopted by a state, whether related to marriage or any other interest, must comply with the Constitution of the United States. The issue the court must address is therefore not who should define marriage, but the narrow question of whether Utah's current definition of marriage is permissible under the Constitution. Few questions are as politically charged in the current climate. This observation is especially true where, as here, the state electorate has taken democratic action to participate in a popular referendum on the issue. It is only under exceptional circumstances that a court interferes with such action. But the legal issues presented in this lawsuit do not depend on whether Utah's laws were the results of its legislature or a referendum, or whether the laws passed by the widest or smallest of margins. The question presented here depends instead on the Constitution itself and on the interpretation of that document contained in binding precedent from the Supreme Court and the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals. Applying the law as it is required to do, the court holds that Utah's prohibition on same-sex marriage conflicts with the United States Constitution's guarantees of equal protection and due process under the law. The state's current laws deny its gay and lesbian citizens their fundamental right to marry, and in so doing, demean the dignity of these same-sex couples for no rational reason. Accordingly, the court finds that these laws are unconstitutional. It wasn't until oral argument in advance of that ruling that it became clear our schedule likely meant that I would be the first federal judge to wade into these issues following the Supreme Court's ruling months earlier. That fact was the source of tremendous stress. As I pointed out in our decision, individual liberty and federalism concerns were aligned in the result in the Windsor decision, but in direct conflict in our case. I can't really describe how it felt to be the first federal judge to offer an analysis of these issues. It was a singularly solitary experience. Of course, I now find myself with some company. Since my ruling, district court judges in Oklahoma, Texas, Ohio, Kentucky, Michigan, Tennessee, and here in Virginia have independently reached the same conclusions, and several attorneys general have as well. The Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals is scheduled to hear argument in the appeal of my ruling 3 days from today. The following week, the same panel will hear argument in the appeal of a decision one of my colleagues subsequently issued in Oklahoma, striking down that state's same-sex marriage ban. While the appellate courts will ultimately determine whether my legal analysis and interpretation of Supreme Court authority was sound, I immediately learned I was right about at least one thing: the robust criticism I expected would be forthcoming in response to my decision. The Deseret News in Utah immediately described my ruling as judicial tyranny. Our esteemed governor expressed outrage that a judicial activist would attempt to single-handedly undermine the will of the people of Utah and substitute his own political policies for those of the electorate. Other commentators have variously characterized my decision as a legally invalid exercise of judicial authority outside the constitutional realm of a federal district court judge, a decision by a radical, impatient judge with an agenda, exercising a total lack of judicial restraint and respect for judicial process, as a decision by a judge on a personal crusade, and my very favorite, my personal favorite, a judicial wrecking ball of freedom. I'm sure any connection to Miley Cyrus was unintended by the speaker. I'm told my decision arrogantly suffocates religious liberty and unconstitutionally elevates federal authority over states' rights in blatant disregard of the 10th Amendment. Many of those speaking out against my decision have been intensely personal in their attacks. At least in part for that reason, I suppose, it's no surprise that so many have expressed their dissatisfaction with my work through threats against me and my family. On the other hand, countless individuals and organizations pleased with my ruling have suddenly concluded that I am a leading light on the bench, a great protector of individual liberties, and a progressive beacon of truth and justice. By the sounds of it, one might expect that I change into my robe in a phone booth and leap over tall courthouses in a single bound. I wish I could flatter myself by agreeing with the latter group, but the truth is that neither depiction of my work is correct in my view. Had I found Utah's laws constitutionally valid, it seems likely to me that many of the same things would have been said about me and about my decision. Those lined up on both sides of the issues may simply have flipped sides in the post-decision debate. And while I have simultaneously been canonized and vilified, I submit both sides missed the mark in a way that undermines confidence in our judiciary. Both positions, prominently and frequently articulated in media reports and editorials, necessarily imply that my own personal views factored into the decision that I reached in the case. They did not. What I sought to do in the Kitchen case was to faithfully discharge the duties of my office by following, as best I could, the legal precedent and analysis provided by the courts above me. The same thing I attempt to do in every ruling that I make. It simply would not occur to me that my own personal views as a district court judge should determine the outcome of cases or issues presented. The rule of law and my oath of office dictate otherwise. Given the pendency of the appeal, as well as the ongoing litigation and appeals in numerous other courts across the country, prudential considerations counsel against saying anything more about the merits of the case. Like many of you, I am intensely interested to see whether those above me think that we got it right. I know that we did the best we could. One thing I can speak to is how the experience of presiding over such an intensely political and publicized case profoundly and directly impressed upon me the importance of judicial independence. Our work in the Kitchen case was enormously difficult and stressful. As I said, I anticipated that whichever way we eventually came out on the issue, we were going to be subject to intense scrutiny and criticism. I'm not exaggerating when I say there were many sleepless nights in advance of the ruling. And none of that stress was in any way related to any concerns about my ruling leading to my impeachment, though there have been calls for that. While I would like to think that I am capable of totally abandoning any concern for my professional well-being, I don't see how exposure to retention or re-election could in any way advance the critically important task of focusing exclusively on applying the rule of law dispassionately. The Kitchen decision provides a great forum and a platform for this discussion. We need look no further than Iowa to see what can happen when judges make politically unpopular decisions in states that utilize retention elections for judicial positions. In 2005, six same-sex couples who were denied marriage licenses filed a lawsuit in Polk County, Iowa, contending that denying marriage licenses to same-sex couples violated the liberty and equal protection provisions in the Iowa Constitution. In April 2009, a unanimous Iowa Supreme Court upheld the decision of a trial court judge siding with those plaintiffs. Three of the justices who participated in that unanimous decision stood for retention the next year. A number of well-funded special interest groups opposed to same-sex marriage campaigned actively against retention of the justices. As sitting judges, the three justices did not campaign for their own retention. Each was removed from office in November 2010, the year following the court's ruling. It might be tempting for those opposed to same-sex marriage to see this result as vindication of a democratic process. But both sides of this issue, and many other politically charged issues, are well organized and well healed. It seems just as likely to me that the same result may have followed had the court ruled the other way. It may have just been the case that it was the other side campaigning for removal. Setting aside any policy views anyone might hold about same-sex marriage, it's hard for me to see how it furthers any of the purposes of our judiciary if organized special interest groups with financial resources can shape or chill judicial decision-making based not on the legal principles that apply, but instead on the issue presented. But it's not just politics and special interest groups that present threats to judicial independence. In the normal course of our work, judges are required to hear cases and decide issues involving private companies, industry, and organizations. In my short time on the bench, I have already been required to rule on issues of great significance to two of Utah's largest employers. Life tenure is a powerful tool for leveling the ground, as my former colleague Dick Burbage said, providing a fair and level playing field for the rich and the unwashed. In this respect, judicial independence promotes those virtues we see depicted in A Blind Lady Justice. As if that weren't enough to persuade me that my dear friend Judge Blanche has the short end of the life tenure versus retention election debate, I've since discovered, after coming to the bench, that other safety valves exist to mitigate risks presented by life tenured judges who wish to remain on the bench even after becoming unable to adequately discharge the responsibilities of their offices, whether as a result of disability, illness, accident, or otherwise. While life tenure guarantees that Article III judges will not be removed from office except under specific circumstances I will next address, the Constitution does not guarantee judges dockets. In those exceedingly rare circumstances in which it is required, the circuit courts have remedies to ensure judges do not harm those that we serve, even if it means in extraordinary cases that sitting judges no longer carry a caseload. Though such remedies often carry costs, they may be a small price to pay for the benefits associated from removing outside political influence from the judicial process. Moreover, as Judge Blanche explained at my investiture, life tenure comes with its own set of special restrictions. I am now going to shamelessly plagiarize Judge Blanche's remarks because they provide such piercing insight into this remarkable constitutional concept. Like all federal officers, judges can be impeached for wrongful conduct. The same Constitution that guarantees our jobs and salaries for life also provides that the legislative branch may remove us from office for high crimes and misdemeanors. At first blush, that sounds like an extraordinarily high standard. High crimes certainly sound like the worst transgressions a federal judge might commit while in office, but remember, the Constitution also says we may be removed from office for committing misdemeanors. My friend disclaims any special expertise or knowledge concerning the meaning of high crimes and misdemeanors as a matter of constitutional law, but he does have experience with what those terms mean as a matter of Utah criminal law. He tells me that in his view, the most straightforward interpretation of the Constitution must be that I can be impeached and removed from office for something very, very serious, like treason, a high crime, or littering, a misdemeanor. Claiming to have my best interests at heart, Judge Blanche advised me that out of an abundance of caution, I should take great care to ensure that any illegal conduct I might commit while in office must fall in the donut hole, if you will, between high crimes on the one hand and misdemeanors on the other. The sweet spot obviously being the third-degree felony. The unlawful release of fur-bearing animals, for example. One could even imagine a judge pleading up to a more serious charge in order to avoid the constitutionally dubious misdemeanor category of offenses. But all kidding aside, my time on the bench has impressed upon me the importance of a strong and independent judiciary, which is essential, in my view, to carrying out the important work of our third branch. On that note, I will move to some very, very brief remarks about my third observation as a recently appointed federal judge. I have always loved this great nation of ours, and I have always believed it to be a special place. Serving our country as a judge has only heightened my feelings of awe for what we are blessed with by virtue of our citizenship here. My great-grandparents came here from the old country. Both of my grandparents served in World War II. One captained watercraft delivering combat soldiers to European beachheads, leading to countless casualties. The other cared for the wounded. A generation later, my father volunteered for two tours in Vietnam, and his body still carries the wounds of that service. My dad worked as a janitor, and my mom as a nurse's assistant when I was young. And though both later achieved great professional success, I am the product of a family that bordered on the poverty line for a substantial part of my childhood. Despite that, there was little doubt growing up in my family that this was an extraordinary nation. It was understood in our family that the freedoms and opportunities we enjoy here come hand in hand with a responsibility to serve and to give back in a meaningful way. It was this commitment to service that led me to join the military the weekend after my 18th birthday, and it was this desire to serve that ultimately caused me to leave a promising law practice for the bench. These words are often spoken, even to the point of being cliché, but I deeply believe that judges are the servants to the parties and the lawyers who appear before us and the communities in which we serve. This is the way I approach our work every day. That service is often the source of great inspiration. For example, one of the most rewarding functions of my office is that I periodically enjoy the privilege of presiding over immigration and naturalization ceremonies to swear in new United States citizens. Years ago, one of the judges in our district, an immigrant himself, designed a program for these ceremonies in which we pass around a microphone to a number of new citizens who come from different and often very distant regions of the world. Each provides their name, their nation of origin, and then explains in their own words what it means to be an American citizen. Many of our citizens briefly describe events that led them to come to the United States. We regularly hear stories of great suffering, often followed by staggering accounts of great sacrifice required to get to the United States. We hear of children from war-torn countries whose parents set them off to the United States with the clothes on their backs and whatever money their family can scrap together, sewn into those clothes. We hear stories of families who together flee under oppression, under the cover of night, and under the threat of great harm if they are discovered. These accounts are often deeply inspiring, if sometimes heartbreaking. We hear from new citizens how much they cherish their newfound ability to speak freely on matters of importance, to practice any religion they choose, and to participate directly in their own governance through a democratic process. It is impossible to leave one of these events without a greater appreciation for the rights and privileges the rest of us tend to take for granted every day. From time to time, high school government classes join us. The experience leaves quite an impression on these students, most of whom have never before considered the enormous price others are willing to pay for the rights that we enjoy. We also found ourselves in court for evidentiary hearings on September 11 last year. That case involved important questions concerning certain patents relating to BRCA genes for breast and ovarian cancer. The issue is of great importance to the parties before us and many others. Hundreds of millions of dollars were potentially at issue. Our courtroom was packed with interested parties and observers. Taking the bench that morning, I suggested to everyone involved that we pause from our important work to reflect for a moment on the significance of that date. As I said that morning, we enjoy here in the United States a rare and extraordinary form of government that allows for the peaceful resolution of serious disputes among citizens in the light of day, in open courts, according to established rules, and subject to appropriate review. From my perspective in a trial court, it is awe-inspiring. I am honored and deeply humbled to serve this great nation of ours, and it has been a tremendous privilege to be with you here today. Thank you all so very much.